Well, it's a great pleasure to speak to you all. I remember the first time I spoke to a women's gathering, my oldest son, who must have been about 9 or 10 at the time, said, what are you doing today, Dad? And I said, well, I'm going to speak to a women's meeting. I said there'll be about 12 or 15 women there. And he said, oh, you're going on a date with 12 or 15 women? He said, that most men dream of doing that kind of thing. So I guess this is a kind of dream come true, speaking to all you ladies this lunchtime about Martin Luther as husband and father. What I want to do, first of all, though, is give a brief history of why it is such a radical thing that Luther was a husband and a father. I think we can often forget that the Reformation changed a lot of things quite dramatically, and one of the things that it changes perhaps most dramatically is the notion of the ministry relative to marriage. If I put it this way, Luther was probably the most significant theologian since biblical times, or the first theologian of significant since biblical times, who was actually a husband and a father. Almost no other theologian that we know of could that be said about. Peter, yeah, we have references to Peter's wife in the New Testament, but really there is 1,400 years of church history where pretty much every theologian that we can identify and know something about was a bachelor, or in the case of many women in the Middle Ages, was a single woman. The marriage estate and parenthood were certainly not legitimately pursued during that time by Christian leaders. So I want to start by giving a little bit of the history of that as a way of setting the scene for Luther's own marriage. Luther, when he got married, of course, was a man who was already well into what would then have been middle age. He was born in 1483, gets married in 1525, so he's in his early 40s, which is definitely well into middle age in the 16th century. So Luther was a man who not only did something radical, he was a priest who took a wife, but he did it at a point in his life when really, you know, that would have been the furthest thing from his mind. As we shall see, the marriage of Luther and Katie is not born in romance, though it becomes a very, very happy one. Why is it that the church was so negative towards ministers, priests being married? It's not immediately obvious when you look at the history, but certainly one of the things you find in the earliest Christian literature from, say, the beginning of the second century onwards is an emphasis upon martyrdom and upon suffering. If you were a Christian in the second century and you had asked me, well, what does genuine Christian faith look like? I'd probably have said to you, well, it looks like physically suffering for your faith in some way. Not that persecution in the ancient world was all the time in all places. It's only in the third century that persecution reaches sort of pan-Roman Empire proportions. But we know from the earliest Christian literature that physical suffering was considered to be of the essence of what it meant to be a true Christian. And that really fed over into the notion of self-control, the repression, the suppression, the denial of bodily urges becomes a way of demonstrating the seriousness of one's Christian commitment. And in the fourth century, this becomes even more powerful because what happens in the fourth century is Rome goes Christian. The empire is Christianized. Nobody's being persecuted anymore. And that question of what does a genuine Christian look like presses in with real urgency. The standard answer is, well, it looks like somebody who's engaged in physical suffering for the kingdom and the empire is no longer producing that physical suffering. Then what do you do? Well, the short answer is you develop something called monasticism. Monasticism rises as a phenomenon in the fourth century when if the empire, if the state isn't persecuting you, you kind of persecute yourself, if I could put it that way. And also what happens in the first three or four centuries of the church is Christianity is very much in competition with pagan views of the world. And one of the sort of virtues of that was well, one of the things that was considered most virtuous in pagan views of the world was the notion of celibacy. So if you wanted to sell your religion as being a superior version of what is out there in the world. What you actually had to do was argue that your religion embodied pagan virtues even more powerfully than paganism itself did. You can actually see sort of trivial, well, not so much trivial, but you know, we do the same thing today, of course, when you think of those people who sell Christianity on the basis that actually it enables you to achieve all of your secular goals only better. That is the modern equivalent of what's going on in the early church. Celibacy was held up by many pagans as an ideal. And the church, in order to demonstrate its superiority to paganism, held up celibacy as an even higher ideal. So by the time you get to the 4th century and the rise of monasticism, we find monasticism embodying in its very essence the notion of sexual continence and celibacy. Various councils pass rules at this point, not imposing but recommending celibacy for those who are in the priesthood. And what emerges very quickly, certainly in Western Christendom, is the idea that the unmarried estate is dramatically superior to the married estate. And that will grip the Christian imagination in the West right the way down to the Reformation. And as I said in my first lecture, or second lecture yesterday, Luther is very much a man of the Middle Ages. He's a medieval man. Luther's calling is to be a monk and a priest, both of which callings require celibacy of those who pursue them in the late Middle Ages. So Luther, as a young man heading towards middle age, is very much committed to the standard church position on marriage and sexual relations. Go to the lecture I gave this morning, though, the last sort of point I made in the lecture. You remember that, the abolition that Luther accomplished between the sacred and the secular. When Luther looked at the notion of what was it that constituted a sacred calling, and argued that it wasn't something that was intrinsic to the calling itself, but was the manner in which the calling would be pursued. So I use Luther's own extreme example of the hangman. A hangman is a perfectly legitimate calling for a Christian as long as you're hanging people to the glory of God, slaying offenders, protecting the innocent, etc., etc. This, of course, raises acute questions about holy callings as thought of in the Middle Ages. If you're going to ride a coach and horses through the distinction between sacred and secular as articulated in the Middle Ages, you're going to undermine and ultimately destroy the notion of the priestly or the monastic calling as then conceived. And Luther articulates these sort of ideas in 1520. 1521, he goes to the Diet of Worms, where he gives his, he's already excommunicated, but he gives his great defense of his writings before the massed ranks of the empire, the young emperor Charles V presiding over the events there. And as Luther rides out of Worms on his way back to Wittenberg, he's kidnapped. Frederick the Wise, his prince protector from Electoral Saxony, has effectively commissioned his equivalents of the Navy SEALs or sort of special operations executive to seize Luther on his way out of Worms. He knows that the world is becoming a very hot and dangerous place for Luther. It would be very good to have him taken out of the picture for a few months, sequestered away somewhere in order to allow the heat to come off him. So Frederick the Wise kidnaps his own man, and Luther is transported to the Wartburg Castle, which stands on the hill high over the town of Eisenach. Eisenach is a fascinating German city. Anybody know which famous person was born in Eisenach? Famous Lutheran, in fact, was born in Eisenach. If I were to say to you that Roman Catholics generally have most of the best tunes, but Protestantism did produce one truly great composer shortly after the Reformation, J.S. Bach. Johann Sebastian Bach, born in Eisenach. So if you're a tourist and you go to Eisenach, you get a two-for-one. You can spend the morning up in the Wartburg Castle, where Luther translated the New Testament into German, and you can spend the afternoon down in the town looking at the Bach museums that are down in the valley. There's also, on the town square there, there's an excellent German restaurant that does most wonderful potato pancakes I think I've ever tasted. Hope it's still open. If you ever visit, go to the German restaurant in the town square. the potato pancakes are fantastic. Luther's taken out of the picture. He's taken out of the picture for 9 or 10 months. He grows a beard. He disguises himself as a Sir George. He disguises himself as a knight. He occasionally goes on little trips around Germany to see how the Reformation's going. There's a famous story of two students on their way to Wittenberg University who arrive at a tavern one night, and they notice a fierce-looking knight over in the corner with a sword reading the Psalms in Hebrew, which is an unusual activity for a German knight to be engaged in, typically. They go over and join this German knight, and the knight spends the evening expounding how Christ is present in all of the Psalms to these two young students. The end of the evening, the knight has left, the students get up to leave, and I believe it's the case that the knight has paid their bill. He's covered their food and drink for the evening. Some months later, they're in Wittenberg and for their first lecture of Martin Luther's, and who should come in but the man they recognize as this knight. So Luther he's occasionally wandering the area, but he's really out of the picture at this point. What this does is it hands the Reformation in Wittenberg at this point over to more radical men. Three men in particular, Philip Melanchthon, Luther's very young, he's sort of 21, 22-year-old associate, brilliant Greek scholar, a man called Conrad Zwilling, and another man who was originally Luther's senior colleague, but whom Luther comes to eclipse, a man called Andreas Bodenstein von Karlstadt. And these three men, particularly Zwilling and Karlstadt, pushed the Reformation forward much faster than Luther would have wanted. And one of the things they do is they abolish clerical celibacy. They abolish the notion of celibacy. If you like, one could say they take the logic of Luther's arguments and push them through in a dramatic fashion. Mentioned earlier how Luther takes 5 years to put together a vernacular liturgy after he wants to put together a vernacular liturgy, because he is an instinctively conservative person who wants to move slowly. Not Zwilling and Karlstadt. They are radicals who want the Reformation to move very fast. And one of the things they do is they abolish clerical celibacy, they abolish monasticism, and they introduce marriage for clergy. Now, rather sort of blunt way of putting it, but one of the reasons why female monasticism arises in the ancient church is the rise of male monasticism. When the men clear off and go into the desert to be wise men, holy men, living by themselves, when they go and join a monastery, in a patriarchal society, the women are left in a bit of trouble. They've nobody to support them. So what we find in the ancient church is female monasticism grows as a function of male monasticism. Jump forward to the 16th century. When you close down male monasticism and female monasticism, what do you find? You find that a lot of single men and single women are pushed onto, you know, put it crudely, the open market. What do you do with them? Well, you tend to marry them off to each other. That's the obvious thing, too. It's the 16th century. Much as the Hallmark Channel sort of presents this lovely sentimental view of love and marriage throughout the ages, whatever movie you watch, it's always marriage is always for love. In the 16th century, yeah, sometimes it's for love, but more often than not, it's for mutual protection. And the logical thing to do when these men and these women are pushed onto the open market is to marry them up together. The Karlstadt-Zwilling Reformation, that sort of terminated. Luther returns to Wittenberg in 1522 to bring calm and a sense of moderation back to the Reformation in Wittenberg. But the word is now spreading. Word is now spreading about the dramatic reforms that have taken place in Wittenberg. And news of the reform movement gets to a town called Nimschen. And in Nimschen, there is a nunnery. And a number of the young nuns there are very taken by this idea of reform that they're hearing about. And one of them, a woman called Catherine von Bora, communicates with Luther, wanting to know what to do about the Reformation. Well, April 1523, an opportunity presents itself for these nuns to escape from the nunnery. It's a slightly sort of distasteful story. If you remember, in the 16th century, people didn't bathe very often. I think it was Elizabeth I who said that she took a bath every 3 months, whether she needed it or not. And she was the queen. She had more access to bathing than most people did. Well, these nuns, who would not presumably have been very high on personal hygiene in the first place, they escape from Nimshan in herring barrels. The local fish seller is passing through, and these nuns hide in the empty herring barrels and escape. You can imagine, they must have smelt pretty bad, I imagine, when they arrive in a sort of late spring in Wittenberg. Group of young nuns arrive in Wittenberg, and it presents Luther with a problem. What's Luther and the leaders of the Reformation, what are they going to do with all of these young women who've just arrived from Nimshan? The first plan that Luther arranges is for these women to be taken in by various people in the congregation to live with them in their houses. Stage two of the plan, of course, is, well, the monastery, the Augustinian priory, where Luther himself was a monk, is closing down. The monks are leaving. There's no point in a monastic calling anymore. And so they start to marry off the nuns one by one to the available monks, until they're left with just the one, Catherine von Bora. And various attempts are made to marry her off to leaders of the Lutheran Reformation, including, finally, an attempt to marry her off to some terrible old skinflints of a Lutheran pastor from outside, a really dreadful-sounding individual. When she refuses to marry him, she presents Luther and his colleague, Nicholas von Amsdorf, with an ultimatum. She will only marry one of the two of them. So take your pick, but she says, I will only marry one of you two gentlemen. And von Amsdorf is very much a committed bachelor. I don't think von Amsdorf ever marries. He's a very close friend of Luther, but he never gets married. So Luther agrees to marry Catherine von Bora. It's not a marriage born out of love at all. It's a marriage born really out of necessity and convenience. And they marry on June the 13th, 1525. A couple of comments about the wedding. One, it's a public relations disaster because it occurs at the height of what's known as the Peasants' War. The peasants had risen up in Germany to overthrow their feudal lords and masters. It's rebellion. And there were terrible massacres of peasants that took place as a result. And Luther marries at the height of the Peasants' War. You know, and you know how it is in the United States, whoever is president, if something bad happens and the newspapers get a picture of the president on a golf course somewhere, it's always a PR disaster. You know, George W. Bush is playing golf or Obama's playing golf. When such and such happens, why weren't they in Washington with their hands on the levers of power? Similar things are said about Martin Luther. Second thing, and this is a slightly distasteful fact, but I always throw it out in order for people to understand the intensity of what is happening when Martin Luther marries, and that is that the consummation of the marriage had to be witnessed. It had to be witnessed because it is such a controversial move. If you could imagine the propaganda coup, I mean, think an experiment in virtual history here. And say to the students at Westminster, think for a moment, what would have happened to the Reformation if Luther's first child had been stillborn? It's a little bit like the lightning bolt, isn't it, last night? When I talked about the lightning bolt, I said, you know, when a lightning bolt happens, we know what it's about. We know that there's this ice crystals crashing around in the upper atmosphere, etc., etc. We can see it as a natural phenomenon, okay? It happens under the sovereignty of God, but we think of lightning as a natural phenomenon. If a child is stillborn, we think of it as tragedy, but we don't think of it as the judgment of God. Typically, we don't think God is being cruel to a particular person by striking their child dead. In the 16th century, that's exactly how they'd have thought. Of course, the lightning bolt's a judgment of God. If Luther's first child is stillborn, that's a judgment of God on the Reformation. I actually think that the Reformation would have taken a very different path if Luther's first child had been stillborn, because it would have been a propaganda coup for the opposition. Same with the marriage, consummation of the marriage. You have to have a witness there to make sure that nothing weird happens. Satan doesn't appear, a demon doesn't drop out of the ceiling There is an account, the person who witnessed it was a man called Bugenhagen, who notes in a letter that he found it a most distressing experience, he says, and I've often thought it must have been 10 times more distressing for the young nun who was marrying this man that she didn't even really love at the time, and had also got one of his friends present to witness the thing. But anyway, Luther gets married. He's given as a wedding present the Augustinian cloister. It's an interesting, almost a symbolic gesture. John Frederick, the Elector of Saxony, the new elector, who's a supporter of Reformation, gives the Augustinian monastery to Luther and his wife as a wedding present. And they will live there for the remainder of their married life. It's a big place. You can go there today. It's still pretty much intact. It's useful that it was a big place because, again, we often forget, but being a reformer was not in and of itself a particularly lucrative career. Luther and his wife struggled for money throughout most, if not all, of their marriage. They struggled to the extent that they had to take in lodgers. That's why it was useful to have a big house. They took in student boarders in order to supplement the salary. They also engaged in market gardening. Katie was also a phenomenal home brewer, as it happens, and ran a kind of brewery from the Augustinian cloister. The last love letter, again, this is it's difficult to lecture on Luther without being distasteful, so you'll have to forgive yet another distasteful interlude at this point, but the last love letter we have from Luther to his wife, he tells her how much he loves her, and then he asks her to brew a particular kind of beer, because when she brews this beer for him, he says he has at least 3 bowel movements before lunch. If you can imagine writing a love letter to your spouse and referring to bowel movements, my wife would kill me if I wrote something like that. But it was a red and tooth and claw kind of culture, if I could put it that way. So she was a great home brewer. They did gardening together to try to raise money. Luther at one point set himself up as a carpenter, but was a terrible carpenter, and so many people complained that he had to stop doing that. It does appear that they grew to love each other. I mean, they had 6 children. We'll talk about the children in a few moments. They had 6 children, raised their children together. If you go to the Augustinian cloister in Wittenberg today, and you come to the front door, there is a beautiful stone doorway. And on either side of the door, into the stone doorway, is built a little stool. And the stone doorway was actually a birthday present that Katie bought for Luther 1 year because she became convinced that they weren't spending enough time talking to each other. So she bought this doorway so that at the end of each day, they could sit on either side of the door and talk to each other. It's a very sort of sweet move on her part. Of course, this is central northern Germany. Yeah, it's like Britain, it rains a lot. So if you go inside and upstairs, there's a room upstairs where they have a similar arrangement in the window. You have the great bay window, and then on either side of the window, there's a little stool built into the wood of the window, where if it was raining outside, not an uncommon phenomenon in Germany, they could sit on either side of the window and talk to each other. They did seem to grow to love each other. Luther was constantly arranging for her to be painted by his friend, Lucas Cranach the Elder. Katie had actually lived in Lucas Cranach's house prior to their marriage. It's interesting that she always complained that Lucas Cranach never captured her true beauty. And she's quite an attractive lady. If you look at the paintings that Lucas Cranach did, she comes across as quite an attractive lady, but not as attractive as she really was, apparently. Which makes me slightly suspicious because, of course, the trick of being a painter in the 16th century, particularly of women's portraits, is you always want to make the woman a bit more beautiful than she really is to ensure that you get paid for your work. Those of you who know the story of the English Reformation will know one of the big blows against Protestantism that comes in 1540 is when Thomas Cromwell attempts to arrange the marriage of Henry VIII to a Protestant German princess, Anne of Cleves, and he does so on the basis of a painting that Hans Holbein did of Anne of Cleves, where she's a very attractive young lady. Henry VIII, when she arrived in England, was horrified at how ugly she was. And it really caused a major crisis. And Thomas Cromwell, for that, among other reasons, was ultimately beheaded. He paid a very high price for Hans Holbein's exaggerations. But anyway, they grew to love each other. They seem to have grown to love each other very much. Luther has one of my favorite Luther books is his Table Talk. Luther would, because he'd always got people staying in the home, there were always guests at the Luther dinner table. And Luther would engage in conversation with them. My suspicion is that conversation with Luther was he conversed and you sat and listened to what he had to say. But a lot of what he said was written down. And some of the Table Talks are very serious. Some of them show him at his witty and humorous best. Others show him at his sort of deeply vicious and hateful. It's Luther, warts and all. One of my favorite Luther Table Talks is when he's talking about a theological student that they sent off, as we send off students from our church today, to do a service, to preach a service at an old people's home. They send this student off to preach at an old people's home where all of the residents are old ladies in their 60s and 70s. And Luther uses this student as an illustration of how to make preaching utterly irrelevant when the student goes and preaches to these ladies who are 60 and 70 about the virtues of childbearing. And Luther uses this as a great example of what not to say and why you should need to know your audience. So there's a lot of a very practical wisdom in Luther's Table Talk. And also he alludes to his wife a lot. He refers to her often as my Lord Katie. It does seem that I think she pretty much ruled the roost in the house. He flags up how, when asked what difference marriage makes, he gives a sort of classic man's answer. One of the times he says, well, the difference makes is now is that my sheets get washed more than once every 3 months and they don't get stiff with sweat before I feel they need to be laundered. Another time he makes a comment, he says, the strangest thing about being married is waking up and seeing a pair of pigtails lying on the pillow next to me and saying, oh, hello. So he has some very interesting views of marriage. He also notes that his wife was very good in terms of his own wisdom. There's a famous incident where he's referring to a radical Reformation leader, a man called Caspar Schwenkfeld, and he refers to him as a son of the devil or something like this. And his wife rebukes him and says that is not an appropriate way for a minister of the gospel to speak about one of his opponents. And that's recorded. And it's very clear that she had strong views on how he should speak. And perhaps of all the people who would sit at table with him, she was the one person who was able to effectively punch him on the nose, bring him to his senses. He also talks about how she was very good in allowing him to keep things in proportion. That he would come home sometimes after a long day of being a reformer, whatever being a reformer looked like, and he would have a headache and he'd be sweating and he would sit in his chair by the fire and he would rant and rave to his wife about how badly the Reformation was going. And then his wife would look up from her knitting and say to him, that's lovely, dear, and don't you know that potatoes have gone up 2 pence in the pound? And he said, and at that point, everything would come back into perspective for him. So she was a great helpmeet from that perspective. Said they had 6 children. There was a lot of tragedy in the Luther household. Again, I think that something that we are thankfully very immune from today is, on the whole, is infant mortality. People in the church are always looking back, it seems to me, to earlier eras and saying, wouldn't it be great to live then? I don't know. I don't particularly want to live in a century where pretty much every house is touched by infant mortality. I don't feel that my life has been impoverished by the fact that I've lived to see my boys grow up to adulthood. I think that's a good thing. I think the modern age, for all of the problems it contains, there are many great things for which we can be thankful to God. The Luther household was touched, as so many households were, by infant mortality. Think of John Owen, loses all 11 children, buries all 11 children, 10 of them in infancy and one as an adult. Stunning the pain that was inflicted on these households. And Luther and his wife have 6 children. One of them dies in infancy, and one of them dies, Magdalena dies, age 13. And it was a terrible, painful blow to Martin Luther. And I have a first-hand account here from the Table Talk of the death and burial of his daughter. And I think you can feel some of the agony in this as being described by his friends. Listen to this. When his daughter was in the agony of death, that's Magdalena, he fell on his knees before the bed and weeping bitterly prayed that God might will to save her. Thus she gave up the ghost in the arms of her father. Her mother was in the same room but further from the bed on account of her grief. It was the ninth hour on the Wednesday after the 15th Sunday after Trinity in the year 1542. Then another account. Often he repeated the words given above. I'd like to keep my dear daughter because I love her very much. If only our Lord God would let me. However his will be done, truly nothing better can happen to her, nothing better. While she was still living, he often said to her, dear daughter, you have another father in heaven. You are going to go to him. Philip Melanchthon said, the feelings of parents are a likeness of divinity impressed upon the human character. If the love of God for the human race is as great as the love of a parent for their child, then it is truly great and ardent. Then the account of his daughter being placed in a coffin, and the coffin was too small for her. Put her in the coffin, the coffin's too small. He says, when his dead daughter was placed in a coffin, Martin Luther said, you dear little Lena, how well it has turned out for you. He looked at her and said, ah, dear child, to think that you must be raised up and will shine like the stars, yes, like the sun. The coffin would not hold her. And he said, the little bed is too small for her. Before this, when she died, he said, I am joyful in spirit, but I am sad according to the flesh. The flesh does not take kindly to this. The separation caused by death troubles me above measure. It is strange to know that she is surely at peace and that she is well off there, very well off, and yet to grieve so much. And there are other accounts of her death as well when Luther is weeping at her bedside and she is comforting her father as he stands at her bedside. So they had four children. I say two of them. One died in infancy. One died age 13. There's a famous painting of Luther preaching, and you'll see in the front pew, Catherine and the children. And two of the children have a scarf partially covering the face. And that is a 16th century convention indicating that those children had died. So the whole family is there, the dead with the living. But the painter is signaling that two of those children have already gone to meet their maker. So theirs was a marriage that was touched by tragedy on that level. Luther, of course, dies in 1546. I don't know how many of you have ever seen the film Shane. It's one of my favorite westerns from the early 1950s. And there's a moment when the bad guys looking across at the funeral of one of the homesteaders, and they're seeing all the homesteaders standing there strong, and one bad guy's turning to the bad guy and says, it's Shane who's holding them together. We've got to get rid of him. He's holding them together. And Luther was the man who held the Reformation, the Lutheran Reformation together, and held the powers of the Holy Roman Empire at bay. 1546, he dies. And he's buried in Wittenberg. And in 1547, the Holy Roman Empire, Emperor Charles V, only then does he dare to launch his military assault on the Lutheran princes and smash the power of what was known as the Schmalkaldic League, which was the military alliance of the Lutheran princes. And his forces come crashing into Wittenberg. And there's a dramatic scene where Charles V, whose entire time as emperor had been dominated by the Luther question, he and his aide-de-camp march into the church in Wittenberg where Luther is buried down at the front. And he stands at the grave of Martin Luther. And Luther was if you go and stand at his grave, he was a tiny man. He was only just over 5 foot tall, I think. It's a tiny, tiny grave. And the Spanish aide-de-camp slashes the painting of Luther that's hanging over the grave. And he turns to the emperor and says, should we dig him up and burn him at the stake? Because that was typically what you'd do with a heretic. If you couldn't get him when he was alive, you'd get him when he was dead. And the emperor just turns around and walks out of the chapel saying, I make no war on dead men. he's done. The emperor's done at that point. But he's taken over Wittenberg, and Catherine has to flee from Wittenberg, at least temporarily, while the emperor is in town. And sadly, she will live the remaining 5 years of her life in comparative poverty. Now, she was not particularly well looked after by the people after Luther had died, and she has an accident in 1552 and dies a couple of months thereafter. So although she was much younger than Luther, she was born in 1499, she dies within 6 or 7 years of Luther's own death. Just as a final few observations, what significance does Luther as father and as husband make to Luther? I would say a couple of things. One, his wife humanizes him. His wife humanizes him in a dramatic way. I think that his priorities change after 1525. And she is able to exert an influence on him. For example, in his abusing of Schwenkfeld, that nobody else could do. Secondly, I think that he becomes entranced with children. What's striking to me about some of Luther's later writings is how often he cites children as examples of Christian faith. That, unless you become like little children, that stream of thinking in the New Testament becomes very, very important to Luther. And he will talk about faith must be childlike. One must learn the catechism like a child. One can never move beyond the catechism of one's childhood. Luther becomes mesmerized, I think, by the idea of children as the best example of dependent faith that one can find in the world. And that goes, I think, to where I started, that Luther is the first significant theologian who's also a father. He was a husband and father. And that did not happen before Martin Luther. That is an important development. And it has its lasting literary monument in Luther's small catechism. 1527, 1528. Luther's wondering how the Reformation's doing in the parishes. How is it doing at grassroots local level? And he gets the Elector of Saxony to agree to a visitation. Every parish in Electoral Saxony is going to be visited by four people, two of whom will represent the civil government and two of whom represent the church. And the results start to come back into Wittenberg in 1527, early 1528. And Luther's horrified. He's horrified that Reformation preaching seems to be having so little impact upon the lives of people. If anything, things have got worse. And he makes the comment in the introduction to the small catechism that, the gospel has been preached and the people live like pigs. They live like swine. And so he writes two things, his small catechism and his great catechism. The great catechism is really a set of sermons. It's not a catechism, even as the larger catechism is. It's an incredibly elaborate document. What he's doing, of course, is he's providing for ignorant clergy basic model sermons. So even if they don't know theology very well themselves, they can at least read something good to their people during the worship service. And the short catechism, the small catechism, is a masterpiece of simple question and answers. Now, Luther's not the first person to produce a question and answer catechism, but he is one of the greatest. And the reason is this: if you read the small catechism, it's clearly written by somebody who has children. For many years, my wife and I at the church where I'm now a pastor, my wife and I, our service, she still does it. I have other things to do on a Sunday morning now. But for many years, we taught together. Well, she taught it and I assisted her, really. She's the elementary school teacher. We taught the 3 to 4-year-old Sunday school class, which I actually thought, as I said, was a good discipline for me as a seminary professor, to have to talk to 3 and 4-year-olds on a Sunday. It's very, very valuable. You laugh, but it's a very valuable experience. But one of the things we struggled with was finding good material. We ended up essentially doing our own. I won't tell you whose material we used, but we basically scissored and pasted it and did our own thing in the end, because so much material for 3 and 4-year-olds is entirely inappropriate for them. And the reason is this: it's all written by people who think they know how 3 and 4-year-olds think, but have never actually taught them themselves. When you teach 3 and 4-year-olds, you very quickly learn that what you think they will understand is not what they can understand at all. Remember, the moment came for us, I think, when one of the lessons was on the invisibility of God. Try teaching the invisibility of God to 3 and 4-year-olds. That is a tough call. An abstract concept in a 3, 4-year-old mind. That's a really tough one. That's a really tough one. Luther's small catechism is beautiful because it's clearly written by somebody who's already wrestling with the issue of how do I explain the faith to my 2-year-old? Because at that point he's got a 2-year-old. And he's having to start answering the tough questions. And he knows how a 2-year-old mind thinks. And it comes through in his small catechism. So Luther's marriage and children actually give birth to what I think is perhaps one of the greatest documents of the Lutheran Reformation, and that's the small catechism. And Luther would agree with me on that, because when Luther, in 1545, when Luther's writing about his life's work, he says, there are only 3 things I've written that are worth reprinting after I die. Bondage of the will, the large catechism, and the small catechism. Everything else, he said, can pass away. Those 3 things are probably worth keeping. So Luther's marriage then, my final point is, it gave him children. It gave him children, and that gave the world Luther's small catechism. Got a few moments, if there are any. I'll take a few. If there's anybody with any questions, I may not be able to answer them, but got maybe 5 minutes for questions before we take a short break before the Q&A. Yeah. That's an interesting question to which I don't know the answer. The question is why didn't Luther's children care for Kate after he died? And the answer is I just don't know exactly. They too may have struggled with poverty. One of them was a rather tragic figure, and that was Martin Luther Jr., who died fairly shortly after his mother. And Luther Jr. was, I often think it's not very advisable for a father to name a child after himself, particularly if the father is a larger-than-life figure. And I think Martin Luther Jr. grew up under the burden of being Junior, being the son of Martin. And he tried to be a theologian, and he was never going to measure up to his dad. And he became a rather tragic alcoholic and died of alcoholism, as far as I understand it. So it may well have been that the children were something of a mess. Their descendants continue almost down, I think, down to the present day. If you know anything about Nazi Germany, the president of Germany when Hitler became chancellor was a man called Paul von Hindenburg. I think he was a direct descendant of Martin Luther. So they did have descendants, but the answer to the question is I don't know why they didn't look after their mother as they should have done. Any other questions? Yeah. Good question. Luther on the Jews, always a tough one to... Yeah, I could give you a 2-hour lecture on that. I'll give you the 30-second version. The problem with Luther on the Jews, of course, is that particularly a treatise he wrote in 1543 on the Jews and their lies, which is essentially a call for, pretty bluntly, a call for a kind of genocide of the Jews, which takes on an even more sinister dimension in the rise of Nazi Germany, when it's republished and becomes part of the canon of Nazi propaganda. There's a very good book being published recently by the Institute for Holocaust Studies called Demonizing the Jews, which looks at the role of Luther's writings in the Third Reich. So that book is a very sinister book. And Luther's last sermon, at the end of his last sermon, he included an appendix, which was a hateful rant against the Jews. Luther and the Jews... If I could put it this way, two things I'd like to say. First of all, Luther's not exceptional in hating the Jews. And when you read on the Jews and their lies, it's actually full of well-established anti-Jewish cliches. So Luther is emblematic of a culture in medieval Europe. He's not a unique person from that perspective. So as he connects to the Holocaust, one would have to say he connects to the Holocaust as part of a tradition of Jewish hatred. A hatred of the Jews. Secondly, I'd want to make the point that Luther's problem with the Jews is not a racial one. They didn't really have categories of race in the 16th century. It's a religious problem. So if you compare, if you look at the Nuremberg laws of Nazi Germany, which were the legal basis for the Holocaust, essentially stripped the Jews of statehood. So they couldn't stay, but they couldn't go either. The Nuremberg laws make it very clear that if you convert as a Jew to Christianity, it makes no difference because it's a problem of blood, not of religion. Even it's bogus science, but that was how they thought of race as a biological category. For Luther, it's a religious thing. If a Jew converts to Christianity, there's no problem anymore. Thirdly, and this is what makes Luther interesting, is I say to students, it's a good historical principle that the conventional, the usual, the normal in any era never needs explanation. You don't need to explain why Englishmen take tea at 4 o'clock. It's what Englishmen do. If you've got an Englishman who drinks coffee at 4 o'clock, that's interesting. You need to explain that one. Well, Luther's writings against the Jews are conventional. They're full of cliches. They're what we expect a 16th century person to do. But in 1523, he writes a book that Jesus Christ was born a Jew, which is a call for Christians to treat their Jewish neighbors well so that they will convert to Christ. So the question about Luther and the Jews is not so much why did he hate them in 1543 as why he appears not to hate them in 1523. That's the unusual thing. And I think the answer is that he thought the Reformation was the end of time, that this is the revival at the end of time, and the Jews are about to be converted and Christ is about to return. By 1543, it's becoming obvious that Christ isn't returning and the Reformation is suffering serious setbacks left, right, and center. And Luther's looking for somebody to blame. And he blames the Turks who are pressing in from the east. He blames the Catholics who have refused to accept the Lutheran Reformation. He blames the Anabaptists because they're crazy lunatics. And he blames the Jews because they have the oracles of God and yet they refuse to believe them. So I see Luther's anti-Jewish stuff of 1543 as a function of his disillusionment with his eschatological position. That's not to excuse it at all. I think Luther's writings of the Jews are hateful. And I think they do play a role in the Holocaust. But I don't think we can blame the Holocaust on Luther. We can blame the Holocaust, I think, on the tradition of anti-Semitism of which Luther was a part, but which had been going on for centuries. So that's slightly more than 2 minutes, but that's my 5-minute kind of account of Luther and the Jews. Okay, is it time to break now? Okay, well, thanks very much for listening so patiently.